listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There was an informal meeting of the defense ministers of the European Union held in Romania's capital, Bucharest, on Thursday. The High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini, held a press conference during the gathering, and we bring you these excerpts from her comments.
Last night, we had an extremely important and positive exchange on women, peace and security. It's a field where the European Union and Member States are working intensively. And is there any problem? Down there? No. Okay, good. It's a field where European Union and Member States are working a lot since many years, and where we coordinate closely our actions together with our main partners and mainly with the United Nations and with NATO. And we were pleased and honored to be joined yesterday evening by the NATO Secretary General and by the UN Under Secretary General. This morning, ministers discussed the way forward on the European defence. You know that since a few years, we have established a completely new pattern of cooperation on European defence. It is particularly a reason of pride for me, because this is a field where European cooperation has been stalling or postponed for decades. And a couple of years ago, we managed to advance on this historic issue. And ministers assessed today that the level of implementation of all the different decisions we have taken on European defence are progressing well. We have decided to consolidate the existing EU defence initiatives, starting from the permanent structured cooperation. We have now more than 30 projects ongoing, and others like, for instance, the European Defence Fund, in a coordinated manner and with a lot of energy and focus on consolidating them and delivering results. I will present a report to the Council on this by the summer. The ministers discuss also the need to integrate the new European Union tools on defence into the national defence planning systems. This is extremely important to make full use of all the potential of these instruments. And finally, our discussion confirmed the need, thank you, for Europe to engage and invest more and in a coordinated way on key technologies, including in the area of artificial intelligence. This is an issue that is extremely important for the entire world and for Europe as well. And I have, we have started the conversation today, and I have the intention of putting the issue of the European work on artificial intelligence on the agenda of one of the upcoming formal meetings of the foreign ministers. Last but not least, I raised again the issue with the defense ministers of one of our military operations, Operation Sophia, that in order to continue its key work in the Mediterranean needs to be supported by consensual agreement among member states. So I invited the ministers to work in this direction in the coming weeks because everybody values the work of the operation enormously. Everybody has restated today the fundamental need to preserve the operation and its work that has brought down the arrivals of irregular migrants in the coasts of the European Union by more than 80%, has arrested traffickers and smugglers, disposed of more than 500 boats used by them. I have invited ministers to work on finalizing an agreement among them in the coming weeks in order to keep this fundamental operation of the European Union at sea. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions. Please introduce yourself and the media you're working for and possibly indicate to whom you're asking your question. I'll start with the gentleman in the third row. Please wait for the mic.
Hi, Representative. I want to ask you, as you've discussed the future of the European Union, how do you see, as High Representative of the European Union, the outcome and the ambitions within the Aachen Treaty in order for them to maintain and strive for the complementarity between EU and NATO, and also to, let's say, to not have a multi-speed Europe within the European Defence Cooperation?
Multi-speed Europe in the field of defence is foreseen by the treaties, and this is why we established the permanent structured cooperation. So there is no contradiction at all in wanting to have closer and more effective and also faster cooperation among some of the member states and keeping the European unity under the Lisbon treaties. This is exactly why we decided to launch the permanent structured cooperation a couple of years ago, and I continue to see and to hear, but most importantly to see, an extremely European approach, both from the German and the French side, but also the other countries that, for instance, have been at the core of the initiative of the permanent structured cooperation back then. I continue to see and to hear the intention to invest in a European framework, and I have to tell you, I've never been nervous about risks of countries going alone or bilaterally or in small groups in this field, because I believe that in this particular field, and maybe also in others, but this is not of my competence from an institutional perspective, the more member states manage to cooperate and integrate their work, being it on capabilities, being it on the industrial projects, being it on operational level, in the European framework, as they are doing, the better it is for Europe.
The Bucharest gathering of EU defense ministers was also attended by the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg. Ms. Mogherini was asked about the relationship between the EU and NATO, as discussed during the meeting?
I can be very brief. The work we have started in the European Union in strong cooperation and close cooperation with NATO at all levels, from the political to the technical one, has started already last year. It is ongoing with very concrete steps that have been taken all along the year. Today, it was not a specific topic on the agenda of the discussion of the ministers, but many of them refer to the positive steps that have been already taken. NATO Secretary General also recognized that very clearly yesterday as one of the positive and very concrete and very clear fields where only the European Union engagement can solve a problem that for NATO is essential. So I think it is really a flagship initiative. Concrete implementation is ongoing, and close cooperation with NATO is ongoing. So from the meeting today, I would say, has come, and yesterday night with Stoltenberg, has come a strong recognition of the good work done so far and a strong push for continuing in this respect.
Rosa Jiménez, Agencia EFE. For the High Representative, if I may, a question regarding artificial intelligence. It has been talked about it today. I would like to know what concrete steps are you working on to make it an asset for defense and not a threat for civilians. And if I may, on Venezuela, regarding the arrest of several journalists from my media, Agencia EFE, in Caracas, do you have already a reaction to it, and do you think this can push the member states to recognize Guaido? Thank you.
On Venezuela, we'll discuss with the foreign ministers in a few minutes, and you will hear more from me later during the day. But let me say immediately now that there is full solidarity with your colleagues, and from the European Union side, there is clearly the request of releasing any journalists that are detained or have been stopped without any reason. We firmly believe that all journalists should be able to exercise their duties and responsibilities and rights in the exercise of their work. And you know that the European Union is and will continue always to be everywhere in the world, including, obviously, in Venezuela, starting from Venezuela today, to support freedom of media and the protection of journalists. So there is a clear call from my side to release immediately your colleagues in Caracas. When it comes to artificial intelligence, it has been an initial debate with the ministers today. The concrete steps we are preparing are to cover both elements, as you mentioned, of getting the potential of the artificial intelligence applied to the defense and security sector, especially in terms of development of capabilities that incorporate new technologies. That can be extremely important on operations on theater and also in terms of efficiency of investments when it comes to that. But also to address some of the concerns that I know very well are there when it comes to the ethical and legal framework within which artificial intelligence is applied in the field of defense and security. In this respect in particular, on both sides, we have started to work along two different paths. One is in coordination with the United Nations that have set up work that is ongoing to try to provide a global framework to the use of artificial intelligence in this respect, and also through the global tech panel that I have established as the European Union with experts from all over the world in different sectors, private, public, to brainstorm in a field that requires, first of all, a common understanding, a common reading, and then some ideas that we believe might come from the European Union on how to provide clear rules and frameworks that would allow us all to develop the potential of artificial intelligence in defense without running risks of the artificial intelligence to be, I would say, if you allow me a non-technical expression, out of control when it comes to human direction. So we are working in this respect, and I would put the issue for formal discussions to the Ministers of Defense in one of the coming meetings before the end of the year, for sure.
The journalists who were referenced in that question, who were detained by Venezuelan authorities, worked for a Spanish news agency and were released later in the day, they will be allowed to continue to report from the Bolivarian Republic. Meanwhile, a massive pro-government rally was held in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. Oil workers had called for the march for Thursday in support of President Nicolas Maduro. And Russia has offered to mediate the situation there. A spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry said that Russia has the, quote, potential and experience, close quote. She pointed to the role that Russia's played in defusing the war in Syria and contrasted it with the behavior of the U.S. in that country. This was a spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova, on Thursday.
As for the humanitarian situation, I would like to dwell on a few points. First and foremost, those are the data provided by the UN, and it testifies to the positive trends on the humanitarian track in Syria. And according to the UN, over the course of the last year, the situation with the humanitarian access has greatly improved. As of January 2019, the number of Syrians who live in the so-called remote areas stands around 1 million people. And this figure is 3 times lower than the level which was recorded by the UN at the end of 2017. Back then, there were around 3 million people. Secondly, I would like to draw your attention to the deplorable situation at the Rukban camp for the IDPs. It is inside the 55-kilometer zone, the so-called security zone around Al-Tanf. The U.S. bears the full responsibility for the dismal situation in the camp because the U.S. illegally occupies this area. They illegally deploy their military base there, as well as provide it with material and technical support. At the same time, they are not in any way providing any aid in the delivery of food or medicine to those who live in the Rukban camp. That's why we need to resettle the camp as soon as possible. And until this happens, we believe that the U.S. should provide proper conditions for the people living in the camp. We urge the U.S. to withdraw their forces from the area around Al-Tanf and to transfer control over this territory to the government of Syria, which could take care of their citizens, and they are able to do that. Currently, the U.N. is preparing a second humanitarian convoy with aid for those who live in the camp, and now they are negotiating the parameters with the government of Syria, and we believe that the UN humanitarian workers would not allow any recurrences of the issues with the first convoy in November of 2018, and namely, they would ensure security and transparency in the delivery and distribution of the cargo. It's important to highlight that Russia's principled approach to the resolution of humanitarian problems in Rukban have remained unchanged. Considering the normalization of the situation in many areas of Syria, we observe a spike in the number of Syrian refugees who want to return to the areas of their permanent residence. The main outflow is observed from Lebanon and Jordan, and since July of 2018, when Russia declared the start of its project to help Syrian citizens to return to their homes, around 120,000 Syrians returned home from abroad. Another relevant topic is the situation in Venezuela. It also remains quite tense. New protest demonstrations were held, but this time on a lower scale, and this testifies to the lack of desire on the part of the opposition to be in contact with the official authorities, although the official authorities are prepared to do that. And New York Times calls, we hear the calls of the opposition leader to topple the official government, and he incites the armed forces to help in organizing a military coup d'etat. And I remind you that he talks about this from the pages of an American newspaper. Whoever tried to publish their article in an American newspaper knows that this is very, very difficult to do. But you can always find a spot for someone that you want to find a spot for. We see how foreign sponsors are publicly supporting this behavior. Apparently, there are no borders for Washington, no economic borders, no state borders, not even moral borders. Unfortunately, we can't say that the threat of armed conflict is long past. The fact that all options are on the table, including a direct intervention into the internal affairs of a foreign state, can be testified by a widely circulated story about John Bolton scribbling in his notebook about 5,000 of American military men who could be or will be sent to the area, precisely into the neighboring states. Judging by the reaction of the government, government's reaction, this was not even discussed in the official level. And the way the public around the world cannot receive an answer to a direct question, what 5,000 military men John Bolton noted in his notebook, and will they will be relocated to the neighboring states, and what will be they used for, the Washington cannot provide a definite answer. And this is another proof that in the United States over the recent years, everything is resolved not through democratic procedures, but through some sort of couloir intrigues and plotting. And this is not what we've seen just only in the recent years, but for many years. We welcome the staunch position of the regional players and actors not to follow suit and not to support the military courses of action proposed by the U.S., and we call upon all our partners, with no exception, to think what role is actually given to them by Washington in the preparation and the use of force in the region, as was the case before in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, and in other countries around the world. And what would be the scope of the humanitarian and migration crisis should those plans come to fruition? Because afterwards, if this concept that is being enforced on the world will be implemented, I can predict and foreshadow. And you know that, unfortunately, our predictions do often come true. In a year or two or so, you will be covering international conferences dedicated to the issue of saving Venezuela. And the global community, including through the resources of the UN and other international organizations, are going to try to find some aid, financial aid, in order to restore this state and its statehood. Regional players will appeal to all the international players and ask them, what should we do and how can we extinguish this fire? This will all take place if now, once again, the scenario propagated by the U.S. will win. Over the recent years, it has not been the case always, and you are aware of the examples, but if this time, if what is being enforced on us as the only option for Venezuela will once again win, the consequences will follow. At the same time, we see that not everyone wants to follow the so eagerly enforced recipes for the resolution of the situation in Venezuela. Many states still want to respect the sovereignty and statehood of Venezuela, and they adhere to the principles of the non-interference into the domestic affairs of other countries. They also support the peaceful resolution of any issues and support the dialogue between the government government and their position in order to prevent further deterioration of the situation. For example, at the UN Council meeting on the 26th of January, we saw a failure to turn the Security Council into a court over the official authorities in Venezuela. And the non-alignment movement said that they will not allow in any interference into the internal affairs of a sovereign state of Venezuela. An example of a well-balanced approach is also the joint declaration of the heads of state of the members of CARICOM, which was adopted on the 25th of January, and the declaration of the 28th of January, which was published on an official resource of the Latin American Parliament, the joint initiatives of Mexico and Uruguay to hold a conference on the 27th of February to discuss the situation in Venezuela, and despite some doubtful ultimatums issued by European countries, we see that the EU in general does not accept the Monroe Doctrine, which is so flashly propagated by the American administration, and we see how rational political forces understand that the only way out of the crisis is to use a broad intra-Venezuelan dialogue which would not be hampered and which would not be fueled by foreign sponsors. On our part, we are ready to get involved as a consultant in the terms of the mechanism which would be acceptable to Venezuela, and we welcome the readiness of the Venezuelan president to welcome such efforts.
And I would also like to say a few words about the next set of American sanctions, which is another part of the White House's plan after the overthrow in Venezuela. The outcomes of such sanctions can be even more significant than results for just one single state. I'm not going to retell the entire set of sanctions. You can access it whenever you want. And we call upon the international society and the countries of the Latin American, the Caribbean, to analyze the possible outcomes of this step. Because we're not talking about just an intent to intimidate the independent people of Venezuela, which has chosen its own pathway of development and which, as a result, has suffered political and economical aggression from outside. And I like when they analyze the internal situation in Venezuela, talk about economic and political indices, social indices, but forget to add facts about the external influence which this country experiences and who is exerting this very influence, which has direct connection to the internal economic situation in this country.
Так вот, если вот этот предлагаемый, предложенный пакет мер
set of measures will be adopted, will be facing a direct pathway towards a catastrophe, which might lead to
unbreachable
damage to the nation.
If
they briskly put a stop to the production of petroleum products, is this something that can be done and what should be done to carry out this plan? And what will be the results of its implementation?
Совсем скоро добываемая нефть, которую Вашингтон запретил покупать у законного правительства Мадуры,
куда
она дальше пойдет? В море будут выливать?
Что с ним prohibited to purchase from Venezuela? Where will this oil go? Has anyone asked this question? Proposed some technical possibilities?
Своих политических целей, реализации своих
political goals, their agenda,
к сожалению, даже не просчитывает элементарные последствия.
Something in the context of which Washington does not calculate other outcomes, which would be evident to every person which would know something talking about a certain area. I'm talking about the production of petroleum products. You know, this looks like a diversion, insurgency, and it takes place not just in political dimension, but and causing geopolitical damage, but it actually has consequences for the environment of the entire region. And we should also note that in the United States we hear more and more voices of rationality. For example, American Press, Washington Post published an opinion of a congressman, a Democrat from California, saying that the present-day policy of the Washington, of the White House towards Venezuela is just disrespectful to the United Nations Charter. I know that such articles are dictated, among other things, by the internal political situation in the United States, but maybe we should listen to the opponents in this case. And we call upon all the rational forces within Venezuela and outside to search for a means to de-escalate the situation in the country. Proceeding based on the evaluations which I have shared with you regarding Venezuela, I would also like to just draw some historical parallels, because international relations are bursting with situations which are similar to the one we see in the world in Venezuela.
These examples are
not to such extent or not as much show the cynicism of cases where political agenda takes the upper hand, but maybe we should doubt the nature of the behavior of certain players. Just a few historical facts. In the early 1860s, two countries with difficult political systems, the Russian Empire and the United States of America, were facing serious internal and external challenges which were caused by pressure of foreign states. Russia was facing the consequences of the War of Crimea, very severe consequences. I'm not going to dwell in detail on the historical side of this aspect. You know it well. At the same time, the United States were suffering internal contradictions and were on the verge of disintegration, and the result of it was the civil war, which you are well informed on, too. And European countries wouldn't mind use the situation to strengthen their position in the Western hemisphere. And Gorchakov sent a note of 28th of June of 1861 to American side, and this text was approved by Alexander II, the emperor. He even signed it, and it explained Russia's position well, stating that we were interested in maintaining the United States as a united country, and maintaining the position of President Lincoln was touched by the text and asked to convey his gratitude to the emperor.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Washington's fourth regime change strategy targeting Venezuela continues unabated. Everything is going to plan. First, sanction the country in ways that punish the poor. Second, back a so-called interim president in Caracas. Third, deny the legitimate government of its export revenues. Is the use of force next? Crosstalking Venezuela, I'm joined by my guest, Pablo Navarrete, in London. He's a documentary maker and founder of AlpoRada.net, In Claremont, we have Miguel Pinker Salas. He is a professor of Latin American history at Pomona College. And in Venezuela, we cross to Paul Dobson. He is a journalist for VenezuelaAnalysis.com, an independent, on-the-ground news outlet. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Paolo, let me go to you first in London here. The last sentence of my introduction is the use of force next? Please reflect on that.
I really hope not. I mean, anyone that has even a cursory knowledge of what a military coup means in Latin America, especially one promoted and led by the US, knows that it will end up with hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands of people dead and human rights atrocities that will deeply affect the society for many generations. We only have to look at neighboring Colombia, which only 2 years ago formally signed a peace agreement between the FARC and the Colombian government. And over those nearly 60 years, 250,000 people died, with millions of displaced and human rights atrocities. And all this took place with the support of the US government, which was supporting the Colombian government. So I think it's very important to be aware of what the US's role has been in terms of military coups in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I think if we were, I think there are a lot of the leaders in Europe and elsewhere, and a lot of the commentariat in the media would be much more critical when it comes to reporting the regime change agenda that the US government is promoting in Venezuela.
You know, Miguel, the reason why I'm asking about force, because one has to wonder what role Elliot Abrams of Iran-Contra fame, and called by many a war criminal, is now in charge of the Trump administration's policy regarding Venezuela. He doesn't strike me as a person that would hold back from using force. And plus, we had, on top of it, we had the legal pad gate with Mr. Bolton saying 5,000 troops to Colombia, which, of course, he wanted the media to see. Miguel in Claremont, go ahead.
Obviously, I mean, I think that Elliot Abrams is not only has a legacy in terms of the death squads in El Salvador and human rights violations and abuses, but I think the other thing is what we saw with Bolton, which is psychological ops. That is the threat of the intervention, the threat of a military presence, and not just from the U.S., but from Jair Bolsonaro, who has been very bellicose on indicating that he wants to see regime change in Venezuela, from Iván Duque in Colombia. The worst case scenario is some sort of border dispute erupts or is fabricated, as we've seen in every buildup to an intervention in the case of Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, in the case of the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin, in the case of the Dominican Republic, the deaths of supposedly thousands of citizens. What I worry about is that. What I worry about is that as they unleash a strategy that is essentially intended to create fissures in the military and look for ruptures and try to instigate one faction of the military to attack the other, that becomes the basis of potential intervention. The social fabric in Venezuela has been torn. It's very fragile sense of social fabric. So it's very dangerous to play with that scenario.
Okay, Paul, I mean, how unified is the military here? Because, of course, we had CNN trotting out a defector or someone that would start working with this illegitimate, self-proclaimed interim president here. I mean, even the commentariat, even in the mainstream media, they're egging this on. How unified is the military in backing the legitimate government, not this government that is trying to come to power with the backing of Washington and its allies? Go ahead.
Well, as with any military, I think, across the world, it to some extent is a black box. It's very difficult to know exactly what is going on within the military. However, it is worth pointing out that all of the public information which the military has omitted in the last week or so has suggested that they are entirely unified behind the constitutional president, Nicolas Maduro. We've seen statements released not just from the high military command, the generals, but also from each arm of the armed forces, from the middle ranking officials, and also action from the base soldiers, which would reinforce this. Last week, some opposition activists who were supporting this coup d'etat took a proposed amnesty law to the rank and file soldiers and the police officers on the outposts. On YouTube, you can see many videos of these soldiers setting fire to this law in front of these activists, which sends a very clear message to them I think. It's also worth pointing out that the Venezuelan Armed Forces is famous for having a patriotic spirit, something which was sown after the 2002 military rebellion, which caused a coup d'etat. This is still very fresh in the minds mm-hmm. of most of the soldiers, and they're very patriotic and very ideologized behind the Bolivarian project.
Okay, Paolo, let me go back to you in London. I mean, one of in the toolbox of John Bolton is to use energy as a weapon, meaning denying exports and whatever exports through refining in the United States would go to this this individual usurping power at the behest of Washington. How effective could that possibly be? And would it put the legitimate government in Venezuela at its knees? I mean, it relies upon these export revenues. Go ahead in London.
Well, look, the strategy that was used in Chile to get rid of Allende, for example, in the 70s, remember Richard Nixon said that they had to make the Chilean economy scream. And so when we talk about the crisis in Venezuela, which is very real, it's incredible the relative absence of a debate around the sanctions that have been in place and what this means. One report put the cost to the Venezuelan economy at $6 billion since 2017. And now with the new moves to essentially steal the Venezuelan oil assets in the US, also in the UK, we've had the Bank of England effectively say they won't be giving the Venezuelan government £1.2 billion worth of gold that it has there. These are all intended to heighten the crisis and to make the economy scream in the hope that that also promotes the social discontent that will lead to the regime change agenda. So what we've seen now is simply an escalation, a marked escalation of a long-standing policy of regime change where making the economy scream is a fundamental pillar.
Miguel, can Guaido pull this off? I mean, what kind of backing does he have? I mean, before all this started, before he swore himself in, 1 in 5 Venezuelans even knew who he was. Has that changed since he took like Napoleon, he put in the crown on his own head here? Has that changed? What is his position vis-a-vis the people and public opinion?
Well, I always said at the very beginning when Guaido swore himself in, it was really a coup within the right as well. In many ways, Voluntad Popular, a very small party that only has a handful of delegates in the National Assembly, here was catapulting above all other parties, and Guaido declaring himself president in some ways was also usurping that position within the right. They're not all united. They're all united in wanting to oust Maduro, but they're not united in terms of what comes next or who should be the leader of the country. So in this sense, I think Guaido is playing a very precipitous game as well in terms of positioning himself, in terms of trying to utilize. But again, I think we need to look a little bit long term. I think what we're looking at is the potential of that making that economy scream means that that will eventually exacerbate conditions in the country, that will exacerbate when food is not available more. There's already scarcity. There's already shortages. There's already long lines. So to exacerbate that, that's the strategy, it seems. And if Guaido and his crew begin to receive funding from abroad and can present an alternative poll, that will further exacerbate the contradictions. They're talking about bringing in ships. They're talking about bringing in quote-unquote humanitarian aid. So again, that's the context in which Guaido is maneuvering, and it's a very dangerous area. It's a very difficult area, but what he seeks to do is to find cracks, again, within the lower ranks of the military, whose families are also suffering, whose families are not receiving the products and goods that they would like. So again, that's part of the contradiction.
You know, Paul, would you reflect on that? Because, I mean, the opposition, it's well known in Venezuela that they actually support sanctions against Venezuela. The worse, the better, okay? I mean, how can people like that be trusted? Or is it desperation that will trump at the end of the day? Go ahead, Paul.
I think, as Miguel pointed out, it is dangerous to talk about the opposition as a unified bloc. We can't refer to them with the same policy lines in general. There are elements of the opposition which are promoting sanctions. Yes, they're currently in Washington, they're in Madrid, they're in Brussels, calling on the international powers to, in fact, worsen the economic situation in Venezuela, which is absurd. No? But there are also elements within the opposition who oppose sanctions, who want to play by the rules, who are Democrats, who are out in the communities doing political work to try and win over supporters. And these are the sort of elements we saw participating in last May's presidential elections. The problem is, as Miguel pointed out, that these elements do not have the backing of the White House, and as such, have been pushed to a second level behind those who do, led by Juan Guaido.
Paolo, in London, I mean, the Maduro government has reached out for dialogue, and it's being repeatedly rejected. And it seems to me that the European Union and its recent actions are very misguided. Instead of pushing for some kind of dialogue to avoid the kind of violence that you have suggested could happen, it's just really misdirected from abroad. It seems to me that they're also culpable in making the situation worse. Go ahead. Last 30 seconds before we go to the break. Go ahead, Powell in London.
Absolutely. The European Union have failed a very important test, and I think we now need to look at the more measured heads in this situation, people like the governments of Mexico, the governments of Uruguay, that have just called for an international conference on Thursday, the 7th of February, in order to find a resolution and to restart peace talks within dialogue between both groups that had been taking place, which is not reported and which contributes to people's misunderstanding of what's taking place today.
Well, certainly Western media is doing its best to mispresent what's going on in Venezuela. All right, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Venezuela. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Miguel and Claremont. I listened to Mike Pompeo's speech at the United Nations Security Council, and I was just aghast that he's pushing the democracy card as usual, okay, when it is anything but about democracy. But from a Venezuelan perspective, we've talked about the misery that's going on in Venezuela because of the economic situation here. But would you say that within Venezuela there is a democracy deficit from, you know, people on the ground looking up? Go ahead.
I think that there are multiple ways of interpreting that question. I think that you have had the empowerment of new sectors of the population who in the past have been excluded from the democratic process. Remember, what brings Chavez to power is the fact that you have a calcified political system, a pacted democracy, essentially between two political parties, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, who had excluded progressive sectors, who had excluded people from the barrios and from the hills of Caracas and from other areas. And essentially had governed the country in a way that favored the middle and upper classes. So what you have in Venezuela with the arrival of Hugo Chavez, the election of Hugo Chavez, is in many ways the opening up of that space. And that creates a bifurcation. That creates a clash, because many in Venezuela were not used to that. They were used to their privileges. They were used to their position as a country emerging supposedly into the modern era. And they weren't used to hearing voices from below, voices from the sides. And I think what we've had in Venezuela is that dramatic opening. Now, what has happened since the death of Chavez? Yes, there has been some actions on the part of the government that I would consider authoritarian. Yes, there has been some actions on the part of the government that I would not support in many ways. I think there has to be a greater opening, a greater level of participation. And the only way to accomplish that is through negotiations. This is not going to be resolved militarily. Long term, the fabric has to be reconstructed in Venezuela, and people need to understand that they can participate in this process.
You know, very well put. You know, Paul, is one of the objectives of these right-wing parties is to go back to the status quo before Chavez, meaning silencing these voices here? And a side question, Guaido and his ilk, are they electable on a national scale? Like, for example, could they collectively, which they have not done in the past, back a presidential candidate if there were to be elections? Meaning, a lot of these oppositions around the world, they're very vocal, but they're not electable, okay? So is it a return to the past, and are they electable? That's why they actually want outside intervention, because democracy, they can't seem to make the system work for themselves. Go ahead, Paul, in Venezuela.
Well, Juan Guaido, I'm going to start by pointing out something which Western media has casually overlooked in all of its coverage of the situation of Venezuela. Juan Guaido, the man who says that the electoral system is fraudulent, doesn't work, the last presidential elections were a farce, and as such, there is no democracy in the country, and as such, he has to be president. This man was elected by the Venezuelan people as a deputy of the National Assembly some years ago. by the same electoral system, which was used last May, with the same automated voting machines, which was used last May, with the same electoral authority, the same international observers, and everything which makes up the electoral system in Venezuela. He was elected, he was declared free and fairly, he took his votes, and when he won, of course it was a free and fair election according to him, but when he lost, or when his people lost, his party lost, it's fraud. No? This is a contradiction which shows the real hypocrisy of these sorts of people. Whether the opposition will actually be electable on a national scale, I think what I can say is that they will certainly get a big chunk of the vote. Whether they will pass the 50% mark or not, I don't know. I think at the moment, with the current demographics in Venezuela, where we have a certain significant percentage of their voters who have emigrated outside of the country and have not registered to vote, I think it would be difficult for them to win a presidential election in Venezuela, even if they were unified. Of course, Venezuelans who have emigrated have the right to vote, but they have to register, and most of them have not registered to vote. And this is a sort of frustration through the consistent losing of these sort of national elections, which has led people like Juan Guaido and Leopoldo López and others to seek ultra-right measures, extra-legal measures, which we're seeing manifested today in effectively an illegal, unconstitutional coup d'etat.
Paulo, in London, I mean, you know, looking at the last presidential election, voter turnout was actually quite low. And one of the reasons for that is that the opposition parties boycotted it. So if we have the current president, if he didn't win, who did in that election?
No, I mean, Maduro clearly won.
Well, that's my point.
There were two opposition candidates that won, and Maduro, the rest boycotted it. And the funny stat is that, you know, Venezuela is demonized, its democracy is vilified, and so a country like Chile is put forward as a kind of neoliberal democratic nirvana. In the last Chilean election, the turnout rate was pretty much the same as that in the last Venezuelan election, when there was a boycott by a large section of the opposition. So it speaks to the disenchantment that people in countries like Chile, which are put forward, and obviously we know that have been subject to US military interventions, which have brutalized their societies, reprogrammed them from socialist orientated societies to very individual capitalist neoliberal societies. Yet in these countries, people don't want to turn out to vote, even when there isn't any type of boycotting of elections. Yet people just omit these kind of stats when talking about Venezuela. And I think, you know, Paul mentioned the hypocrisies, and there are hypocrisies abound when talking about Venezuela. When thousands of children died in Colombia a couple of years ago, the media didn't have week-long programs discussing the deaths. And this is in the government funded by the U.S., you know, by the U.S. government as well. But yet the deaths of kids in Colombia don't make the news. But the very real crisis in Venezuela seems to be in everyone's face 24 hours a day. And so we have to really ask ourselves, what are the agendas of the corporate and Western state-funded media here?
You know, Miguel,
can I just jump in there, Peter?
Go ahead, Paul. I'll go to Paul first, and then Miguel. Go ahead, Paul.
Just very quickly, I want to draw to your attention of the viewers that the man leading this coup circus, President Donald Trump, the man who claims that Venezuela is a dictatorship, that there is no democracy, and so on and so on and so on, despite the fact that the numerous American international observers looked over the elections and declared it free and fair. Donald Trump was elected with less votes than his competitor.
That's a good point.
So with what moral authority can he claim there is no democracy in Venezuela when the losing man in the United States is elected president?
Well, I mean, if I could say to all three of you, I mean, the rank hypocrisy of alleging Russian meddling in the 2016 election, and the kind of meddling that the United States overtly, very proudly, and the mainstream media trumps along with him, okay? I mean, that kind of hypocrisy is just, you know, it just stinks to high heaven. Miguel, you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
that would complicate the question of the May 20th election last year, because precisely because the opposition was going to boycott, there was also a lot of number of individuals who have been part of the political process in Venezuela who opted not to participate, wanted to send a message to Maduro that they were not happy with his actions, that they were not happy with his policies. In Venezuela, it's called el voto castigo, a punishment vote. And not only was Maduro the recipient of that, Chavez had been the recipient of that as well. And we're also hearing from the opposition that if they come to power, they will not be elections in 30 days, as the Constitution indicates, but they were going to wait a year until all the people outside of the country can register, until they can purge the electoral vote, until they can purge the electoral rolls, to make sure that the outcome, I would assume, is something that they're more favorable with. The large question is going to be, if they topple Maduro, how will they fight among themselves to put forth a candidate, or are we going to see each one trying to preserve their power base?
Oh, no, each one of them. Let me go back to each one of them, going back to London here. They'll all go to Washington and they'll figure it out in Washington, maybe in Langley somewhere. That's what they will do. Paulo, where is this going? Because it seems to me that with this Abrams appointment, there is a real commitment for regime change here. And it's also, given the fact that through the entire the continent of South America, the absolute distaste of American military intervention, this is a very nasty brew presented to us. And like I have said, I'm going to stay with this topic on my program here. It's the poorest people of these countries that always suffer the most. Go ahead, in London.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the U.S. Has shown that it has no interest in democracy in Venezuela. It's obviously not the reason why it wants regime change in Venezuela. I think the appointment of Abrams is extremely dangerous and completely meant to signal to the Venezuelan society that they should expect to be brutalized by the U.S. government. Anyone that looks into this guy's records show his involvement with criminality in what happened in Nicaragua with the Contras, in El Salvador, his role in Iraq. This is a signal to say that we will want regime change and we are prepared to be very brutal about bringing it. And it reminds me of the quote by Madeleine Albright about the price worth paying of half a million Iraqi children. I mean, the U.S. basically is desperate for regime change, and it is willing to sacrifice tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people to achieve something that it's been trying to get for nearly 20 years now.
Okay, Miguel,
and the poorest will suffer the most.
I'll give you the last word, 40 seconds. How does oil play in all of this? Petroleum, 40 seconds, go ahead.
Oil has always been in the background. Oil will continue to be in the background. I'm not convinced that in this particular moment, given the glut of oil in the world markets, that oil is the central concern. I think it's ideological in many ways. I think it's a return of Bolton, Abrams, and the crew that brought us Central America, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Iraq. They want to remake Central Latin America. And we've seen this clearly with Bolton's speech about the troika of tyranny, which the Venezuela is first, but then will come Nicaragua, and then will come Cuba, so that they want to be able to clearly establish their hegemony over the continent, and they still see this as unfinished business.
Unfortunately, Miguel, I think you're absolutely right. You know, this is like ideological possession. It's the goal is an ideology, but in practice, it has nothing to do with the well-being of the people on the ground. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in London, Claremont, and in Venezuela. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.